As he mentioned, I'm a professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at Northwestern, but I also am in New York quite a bit. I have this is my third book, and my first two projects focused on South Asian Americans in Silicon Valley as well as Asian Americans in advertising. And those two were both books that I published with Duke University Press. And so I kind of took a bit of a gamble going with what we know as a trade press. It's Basic Books published this book because I wanted to make my research available to a broader audience. So in line with that, what I'll present to you today are some broader findings from my book, framing them in the context of Asian American communities and these questions around generation that I've been thinking about. So we hear a lot and read a lot about baby boomers and Gen X and millennials and Gen Z, but very infrequently do we actually hear about where minorities fit into that. Like, where do different communities of color, where do different immigrant community groups fit into this bigger schema of these demographic generations? So I'll touch upon that in my talk today as well. So with that, I will get started. So I'm not going to do the thing academics do, which is read their entire paper, because I know no one wants to be read an entire paper on a Friday night. However, I will read portions because I think that it'll give you a sense of the kids themselves and some of their quotes in the interviews and the ways that they talked about what they did. How many words can you spell until the dictionary defeats you? Elite speller Chetan Reddy asked rhetorically. I spoke to him and his father Vijay via Skype in 2014. For Chetan, winning meant being the last person standing once the dictionary had slayed everyone else. Chetan began competing in spelling bees for children of South Asian heritage in the United States in first grade. A Dallas native, Chetan made it to the Scripps National Spelling Bee in fifth grade and every year after that, until he aged out of his spelling career at 14. As Chetan showed promise, his parents got more serious. His father, a mechanical engineer, prepared word lists for him. His mother, a software engineer, designed applications that allowed Chetan to review about 1,000 words per hour. An algorithm built into the program tested him more frequently on words that he missed. Chetan gradually increased his preparation time from 2 hours a day in fourth grade to 4 hours per day in eighth grade, studying up to 8 hours a day on weekends and holidays by the end of his spelling career. Mr. Reddy told me that only a small percentage of kids prefer to spend such vast hours studying spelling bee words over playing video games, watching television, or indulging in other recreational activities. Along the way, Mr. Reddy quit his day job as an engineer to start a spelling bee preparation academy, focused mainly on grooming Chetan for this competition. When I asked him why they took this language arts exercise so seriously, he told me, "We wanted our son to win. The National Spelling Bee was our Olympics." Chetan never did win, with fifth place being his best finish. But Mr. Reddy continues to grow his academy in Dallas, which attracts aspiring spellers through word-of-mouth marketing in the South Asian American community. Over the years, Mr. Reddy has met families who relocate to new towns and change schools for a better chance to make it to the Scripps National Spelling Bee. So what is it about this particular competition that you don't see with the Math Olympiad or Science Fair projects, Mr. Reddy queried. Why do people give up everything for spelling bees? He pondered. As he sees it, the Indian American community is, quote, focusing on the right things, academics, and the success of their children. Mr. Reddy's remark made me ponder whether these were slowly becoming the priorities in childhood for Generation Z more broadly. So my talk today focuses on this community of South Asian American spellers to offer preliminary connections between generation competition and the changing nature of childhood for Generation Z. I do this in part by presenting research that I conducted at the National Spelling Bee. So each time an Indian American wins the National Spelling Bee, some attribute this win to this ethnic group being naturally gifted at spelling. Even respected journalists have only half jokingly written about an Indian American spelling gene. Of course, there's nothing natural about spelling for any human. Spelling is a completely arbitrary representational system learned through focused study of etymology, grammar, and some memorization. So here I was really interested in understanding what was going on in terms of this trend and how the history of Asian Americans to the United States contributes to this winning streak. Likewise, I was curious about what this process can show us about Asian American racialization, especially for Generation Z, as well as their parents. So these are some of the questions I address in my book, Beeline, in which I connect the rise of childhood competitions to generational shifts, especially as we see childhood becoming increasingly professionalized for Generation Z. So Generation Z, what demographers are saying is that it spans the years of 1997 to 2012. And what we know about Generation Z definitively through the census, primarily, is that Generation Z has the most children of immigrants, as well as the most mixed race children, resulting in this generation having the most people of color since the U.S. Census began to collect this sort of data on race and ethnicity. And while there isn't a whole lot known about Generation Z, what is emerging so far out of studies include these aspects of childhood. There's an increase in competition. Those of you who might enjoy watching reality TV shows like Top Chef or Master Chef or Dancing with the Stars may know that there is a junior imprint of all of these that have come out in the last few years. So kids anywhere ranging from the ages of 8 to maybe 14 or 15 are participating in the junior versions of these contests. So this is one aspect of competition. Another aspect, of course, is what I talk about in my book and that I'll talk more about here with you today, is this idea of brain sports and this idea of competitions like the National Spelling Bee, like the National Geographic Bee, and other such contests that have become increasingly heightened for this generation. Some of you may know that, you know, for instance, in New York City, chess has become really big, and parents fly their kids to various chess contests on their own. You know, they pay for those expenses and they watch their kids compete at a national level, whereas even a generation or two ago, those sorts of opportunities were not as readily available. This is also the most digital generation. They've grown up with screens. They've almost always, for most of their lives, had smartphones available to them. And they're very, you know, this is just part of how they interact with the world. Likewise, it's a generation that has really emphasized social activism. And it could be because things have gotten so horribly bad that they don't have too many other options. But if you think about the ways that Gen Z kids have organized around climate change, gun control, the DREAM Act, you know, various political struggles, it certainly, I think, gives us adults a lot of hope in terms of what changes that they might be able to bring about through this activism. And so some of these drivers of change are fairly evident as well. You know, the increase in technologies, especially social media and other kinds of digital communication, have been making a strong impact on Gen Z. But as well, the immigrant parenting styles, which is something that I study here and elsewhere, to try to understand if immigrants, if children of immigrants are one of the largest groups in Gen Z, what are those parents doing? And how are they bringing about changes that may affect kids beyond their own? And all of this is occurring within the rise of global conservatism that is sadly quite evident here in the United States, but as well in Brexit and in South Asia and in many other regions. So when we think about all of these aspects of generation, one of the things I tried to understand is who is producing these studies, because there's a real dearth of academic studies on generation. And one of the main areas where a lot of this data is produced is out of marketing. So for instance, after I published my book, I found this great study that came out later in the summer last year. It was produced by the United Nations Foundation, but it was done so in conjunction with a company called Brand Asset Valuator Consulting, which is a subsidiary of global marketing giant Young & Rubicam. So just to give you a sense, like, it's very hard to learn anything about these generations that doesn't come out of somebody's marketing agenda. And this is the case with many of the other studies I found, which very selectively report on Gen Z consumption habits, Gen Z's media tastes, and so on, without really giving you a great balanced sense of who this generation is. Another area that I would like to think through in as I think about generation, and some of these reflections are in my book, is, you know, how can we decenter the white middle class emphasis of this generational literature by really more carefully considering the contributions of immigrants and the impact that they might be making on their generations? So, you know, to give you a bit of perspective, Generation Z is a group that by the time it's still growing, because as new people immigrate, they get added to this category of Generation Z, they're going to net out somewhere between 77 million and 83 million. So this is a huge, this is a huge cohort. They're not going to quite outnumber millennials, but they're going to rival millennials in terms of their size. And so, as social scientists have looked at generation, we haven't looked at it on that scale. And this is where I think academia and people in Asian American studies, as well as my discipline, anthropology, you know, need to think through how to go from these smaller scale ways of thinking about generation to larger scale work. So I don't think, do I have any academics in here? One. All right. One and a half. I'm going to count you as a half, Anthony. Okay. Anyway, I won't spend much time on this, but just to give you a sense, the first person to really talk about generation in anthropology was Margaret Mead, who was quite a, you know, prominent public intellectual. In the 1970s, she had a really interesting column in the women's magazine Red Book. And she would kind of crowdsource, before that was a term, questions from writers and from that would emerge in talks that she was giving, and kind of give broad parenting advice. But a lot of it comes from her early work that she did in the island of Samoa on puberty rituals and how people move from childhood to adulthood. This has like brought about a bunch of different kinds of studies, usually people studying children or people studying the elderly, because much of anthropology until this point, and it still continues to primarily focus on adult populations. As well, you have literature coming out of sociology. Carl Mannheim is a very prominent sociologist who was writing contemporaneously with Margaret Mead about the problem of generations. And Mannheim's approach, which has been taken up by various sociologists, is really interesting because it has this sort of social forces idea. And this has been very prominent in how demographers have taken up the idea of generation. So the main demographers who have studied generation, you might be familiar with these two because they're credited with basically starting this whole public conversation. William Strauss and Neil Howe, Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069. It's a kind of an irresponsible subtitle. Really, no one can cover that much time in one book. However, they aim to do it. And their book generations and all of the subsequent books that they publish have really popularized these categories. So you have baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964, the post-war baby boom, and this is, of course, where OK Boomer started from this term. Generation X, which is individuals born between 1965 and 1980, that's my generation, and there's so little work done on it, and I'm bitter. But there's nothing interesting written, really, on Gen X. And then millennials, about which there's been a lot written, a lot of it quite unfair, but they're born between 1981 and 1996. Finally, Generation Z, born between 1997 and 2012. Does anyone know what's coming next? Who's the 2013 onward generation? Generation Alpha. They had to restart. They ran out of letters. So that's what they're calling it until probably the New York Times has a naming contest, and then they pick a better name. But for now, the placeholder name is Generation Alpha. So I'm interested in thinking through how a generation that is this diverse and this vibrant and, you know, doing things from climate change activism like the bottom two slides or the DREAM Act, how can we think about diversity in a more meaningful way? And especially when you're thinking about Asian Americans, what kind of impact are Asian Americans having on the millennial generation and especially Generation Z? So these are the questions that I brought to my ethnographic fieldwork as an anthropologist that I did at the National Spelling Bee. So for every year between 2013 and 2018, I went to the National Spelling Bee in National Harbor, Maryland. It used to be held in Washington, D.C., and now it's in National Harbor. And I went for the full week of events called Bee Week. Has anyone here a former speller and has been to the National Spelling Bee? You'd be surprised. I often find people who have, especially in New York. So Bee Week is a whole slate of events that are organized to basically get kids, you know, to feel relaxed and comfortable and make them feel at home in this competition. So they have a barbecue. At the end, they have a dance party with a DJ and lots of candy and sugar. On the right side, they hand out these cute, chunky autograph books called Beekeepers, and they have each other, you know, you can walk up to people and have them sign them as an icebreaker activity. So one of the things I did is I would meet spellers at Bee Week and then interview them and visit their homes and work with them outside of the spelling bee. I interviewed past and present National Spelling Bee semifinalists as well as finalists, including 17 champions, as well as parents and numerous adults who are in some way connected to the spelling bee. I also spent a good amount of time with ESPN's broadcast and production of the spelling bee, which ended up being a much more elaborate production than I had initially realized, because, you know, they produced the entire thing live for, now it's 3 days long. So a lot of it is a web broadcast, and then it's running during the day on ESPN2, and then there's a live night broadcast. And they pulled these giant trailer trucks into the back of the Gaylord Convention Center where the spelling bee is held. And that's the inside of the truck. It's full of these, I don't know, I don't do media production, so I wouldn't know which screen to look at, but there's a lot of kind of real-time production going on of this, and then it gets kind of beamed out through the satellite dishes. So I got to kind of think through all of this as a way to better understand how kids who participate in the spelling bee are represented by ESPN and how that furthers this idea of who Asian Americans are in the public imagination. So to think through this, the kids that I met early on were in college by the time I finished my research. So I got to follow some of them kind of for several years through their spelling career. So the Generation Z spellers I spent the most time with were usually of South Asian heritage. And they're part of the latest wave of largely professional migration that began in 1965 from South Asia. So to give you a very brief overview of South Asian immigration to the United States, pre-1965, you saw for about 150 years until 1965, a mere trickle of immigration from the United States. And all of that stopped in the early 20th century. And those early immigrants, mostly men, were not able to really set up communities that reproduced themselves. They often had to intermarry with other groups. The most kind of documented case of this we see is Punjabi American men marrying Mexican American women in California. And so this would be in the 1920s, 1930s, 40s, et cetera. But there's really no presence in terms of a community, unlike, for instance, the kinds of Chinatowns that were built or Japantowns. You didn't see any kind of visible urban presence of South Asian Americans until after 1965. So in 1965, as we know probably from everything we've read about Asian American communities, Congress passed what is widely considered the most liberal immigration law to that point, the Immigration and Nationality Act, which established quotas for skilled migrants. And it came into full effect in 1968 and abolished discrimination against immigration based on national origin. So what's interesting is that although there were a lot of professional immigrants who came as a result of the Hart-Celler Act, many of them also sponsored other relatives. So you had a mix of professional and people who came with a variety of educational and job qualifications. In the late 1980s, however, unprecedented growth in capital-intensive high-tech industries and services again forecasted a real severe shortage of skilled workers in the United States. So once again, there was a call for STEM workers, science, technology, engineering, and math. So the 1965 Act paved the way for the Immigration Act of 1990. And this act was enacted by George H.W. Bush. And this act's passage incentivized those with advanced degrees, and especially those who were in technology. So India became one of the top five sending countries, and by 2000, they constituted the fourth largest immigrant group in America. Nearly three-quarters of the South Asian population in the U.S. arrived after 1980. So now, if you watch the Spelling Bee, in the last decade, it's become something of a cliche that an Indian American kid will win. Did anyone watch it last year, in 2019? There were how many winners? Eight. That's right. There were eight winners, seven of which were Indian American. This one white kid got in. She's from Huntsville, Alabama. It was great that finally there was a little bit of a mix of kids who won. But the first winner, Balu Natarajan, hoisted the trophy in 1985. Balu is someone who has kind of stayed connected with the Spelling Bee. He's a doctor in Chicago. He's a Northwestern alum where I teach, so I got to interview him. And what's interesting about him is he's one of two people that I met who is a second-generation Asian American who wanted to do this with his kids, and he's the only champion to have a child participate in the Spelling Bee. So his son, Atman, has kind of followed in his footsteps to some degree and been participating in the Spelling Bee as well. But it was really the 2002 documentary Spellbound, in which Noopur Lala, the 1999 champion, her win is featured there, that got countless families interested in spelling. And also, you know, kind of gave many Indian American families this sense of, well, if she can do it, so can my kid. You know, it really seemed to open a pathway to how to do this activity. So in the United States, no immigrant community has embraced spelling as completely as South Asian Americans. And this is so because they have two B's that are exclusively for children of South Asian parentage, the North-South Foundation Spelling Bee and the South Asian Spelling Bee. So the North-South Foundation Spelling Bee is run by the North-South Foundation, which is an organization, a not-for-profit community-based organization that is entirely volunteer-run. They hold all of these educational contests and charge, registration and admissions fees, and all of those fees go toward the toward literacy efforts in India. The South Asian Spelling Bee is pretty much the opposite of that. It partners with various, it's run out of an advertising and marketing company. And, they partner with various insurance companies. So in the regional contests, they have parents come and, while their kids are taking a written test, the parents sit through an insurance presentation. So they're trying to, kind of wed these two objectives of having their sponsor, generate business while also creating this prestige activity for these kids. So many people I spoke with felt that this sort of minor league circuit that happens in the summer after the spelling bee gives Indian American kids and South Asian American kids more broadly this increased opportunity to be participating in the National Spelling Bee and maybe excel in the National Spelling Bee. And what you see is the kids who are who do well in these tend to really advance far in the National Spelling Bee itself. And so when I attended some of these competitions, this is kind of what they look like. They give out the shirts, so everyone's wearing the shirts, and they have cameras and they're producing this for a television broadcast similar to Scripps. This is the Dasari family, and both their kids participated in competitive spelling, and when they finished, both their kids finished their spelling careers, so to speak. They went on to start a spelling bee academy. And like the first parent that I mentioned, both the kids are now coaches as well. And so they do a lot of coaching on, it used to be when I started this research in 2013, there was only one coaching company. And it was run by a woman named Linda, and her daughter, Valerie, had participated in the spelling bee in the 90s, and she had a whole curriculum set up. By the time I finished in 2018, everybody was a spelling coach. Every kid who made it to the National Spelling Bee Finals and wanted to do this just, gave out their Skype handle, and their parents set them up with Venmo, and they were a coach, because coaching is pretty much the most unregulated industry in the United States that has kind of like a formal name. So all of these kids really got into this. And one of the ways that the Dasari family explained that they that they got into spelling is through word of mouth. They went through these community contests, their kids got interested, they got interested, and they learned from their community how to prepare for these competitions and how to think about training their own kids for this competition. So this sort of word of mouth, kind of follow, like spelling spreading via ripple effect is one way that this has actually, the spelling bee has taken on such strong popularity in South Asian American communities. Now, this is probably quite unexpected for the people who set up the National Spelling Bee in 1925. So this is a photo from the first National Spelling Bee. This photo is taken outside of the White House. As you can see, there are only 9 children participating in it. Today, over 500 participate in it every year. And spelling bees, for those of you who might be unfamiliar with their history, were basically a grammar school classroom exercise that was founded as a way to standardize American English as a distinct language variety from British English. So it was, Miriam Merriam-Webster is the dictionary that the first dictionary of American English, but this dictionary was initially authored by Noah Webster, and Noah Webster kind of peddled this dictionary to various schools, and the teachers would, you know, try to ensure standard pronunciation as well as standard spelling, and then it would culminate in a classroom contest, and that's how we got spelling bees before they became this huge kind of televised national contest. Now, as I mentioned earlier, they're part of this bigger pantheon of kid activities called brain sports. And brain sports is a term that some parents that I spoke with explained what they were doing with their kids. So often kids who participated in the National Spelling Bee would also participate in the National Geographic Bee. There's an International Brain Bee. Of course, there's Math Counts, which all the Indian American kids told me, we don't bother with that because the Chinese American kids own it, which I thought maybe that's true. I don't even know. And then, of course, there are other newer competitions. Like there's something called Child Genius, which is like you have to be good at everything, and then you get college paid for if you win. That's on the Learning Channel and so on. So if you think about these brain sports, they are actually fairly intense. And one of the parents, as she explained it to me, said some families spend so much time on travel soccer and travel baseball, and this is our mental sport. Our brain sport that we encourage. This is how we spend time with our kids and take them to various places in ways that develop them as people. So the kids who get very good at spelling are known in the spelling bee world as elite spellers. So you can see with the speller on the left, Lucas, that he has like kind of a classic spelling bee posture. Like he's not fidgeting. He's like very... keeping, you know, very focused on the pronouncer. He's right in front of the microphone. It's right by his mouth. And he's going to cycle through all of the right questions in order to make sure he doesn't slip up at the mic. So he'll ask language of origin, part of speech, can you use it, what's the definition, can you use it in a sentence, etc. And spellers who do this year in and year out, who spend this kind of copious time preparing for spelling bees, call the ages that they do this, between 6 and 14 primarily, their spelling careers. So they have these whole careers during elementary into middle school that then end pretty much abruptly in eighth grade. So when you think about this sort of intensity of elite spellers and spelling careers, to me, I had to wonder, well, who are these parents and what are they, like, what role are they playing in having their kids participate in these fairly intense activities? So in terms of U.S. parenting styles, the names of these parenting styles primarily come from popular literature and from demographers sometimes, and they're ridiculous. You've probably heard some of them. So the two most prominent ones are stealth fighter parents and helicopter parents. So we all kind of have probably heard of helicopter parents, right? Like these are the parents that hover over their children and micromanage everything in their lives. I see some nodding. Self-fighter parents are supposed to be of a slightly different ilk in that they're always monitoring, but they're kind of surveilling from a distance. And then if something goes wrong, they just bomb the crap out of it and get involved and fix it and then move on again. So the key difference in the shift between helicopter parenting, which is something baby boomers are credited with doing with millennials, and what Gen X parents are doing with Gen Z kids, is that it's supposed to push them toward having a bit more independence, right? So this is something that is supposed to really, you know, come out of this like kind of vague military analogy. And if you really start reading this parenting literature, which I don't suggest you do unless you really want to be amused, like there are all kinds of parenting names. Like there's a potted plant parenting for like, just like if you want to be a potted plant in the corner of a room, just taking it all in. I mean, there's any, like name an object, someone has named a parenting style after it. So these are the kind of prominent parenting styles for U.S.-born parents. You know, of course, with Gen Z, we have to also think of immigrant parents. And so the most kind of prominent parenting style, I'd say, of the last decade easily is espoused by Amy Chua in her memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And so when this book was released in 2011, you know, and the Tiger Mother, for those of you who might not be familiar with this, is someone who believes, is of Chinese, Chua refers to them as Chinese mothers who believe that their children can be the best students and that academic achievement reflects successful parenting. So the concept of tiger mothers is contentious because they use these methods that people consider to be very extreme or harsh. Like in one interview, Amy Chua called one of her kids trash before everyone used the word trash to refer to everything. Like she, and then people, you know, really sparked serious outrage. But what's also interesting is that it's pretty much the only book written that, you know, that isn't by white middle-class parents for a white middle-class audience. So it really stands out in that way, too. So while Chua's memoir stood out to me as quite extreme, it was also, you know, it certainly had some points that I thought resonated with some broader Asian American parenting styles. And so one of the, this Chua's extreme version of parenting has thankfully also drawn ire from Asian American studies scholars who reject the severity of her approach, but they nonetheless identify distinctive features of immigrant parenting that she also mentions in her memoir. You know, these scholars find that Asian American parents are more likely to be authoritative than collaborative in decision making concerning their children, which should come as no surprise to anyone raised by immigrants that they're not looking to collaborate with you. And also that, you know, they don't do this to the extent of forcing their children to perform to perfection. So the style of parenting I talk about most in my book is called B parenting. The B parents I met were predominantly Indian Americans who immigrated based on their exceptional STEM education and professional training. Since they came for the opportunities made possible by their education, it was no surprise that they valued education highly themselves. And what's more, they consistently prioritized academic opportunities for their children, often above their own social lives and leisure. So sometimes there was a happy confluence of them getting to kind of create a community of spelling bee families in their world, but otherwise, this is kind of how they spent their time in the spelling bee world. When I spoke, one of the reasons that this activity continues to be really important for this community, this is Kevin Nagandhi, he's an ESPN host, and until Indian Americans started winning consistently, people had called the National Spelling Bee the orthographic Super Bowl. And Nagandhi claims it's now the Indian American Super Bowl because this is how dominant Indian Americans have been. Other people have kind of offered a darker take on this, calling it the Desi Hunger Games, Desi being South Asian American, because of the kind of really intense competition that does play out in these. And has anyone seen the documentary Spellbound? I know it came out a long time ago. It's a wonderful documentary that really holds up and it won an Oscar. In Spellbound, there are two Indian American kids. One is the one who wins. And when I spoke to her, she was very kind of even keel and balanced about the whole thing. And that's how she comes off in the film. The other family, the father is very worked up about his son, Neil, winning, and he promises to sponsor a feast for their entire village in India if Neil wins. And Neil doesn't win. And so it becomes this much higher, much more high stakes activity than anyone had originally intended. And then, you know, this raises the question of, is this a lot of pressure on the kids? Who is actually driving this process? And so on. So let me wrap up by saying that, yes, these are very professional parents who, you know, most of them who came based on their educational qualifications have managed to get jobs and do have like stable middle class lives. What's also interesting though is that often their wives are well educated as well, but it's the man who has in the marriage who has the work visa, and the women don't get work visas often. So sometimes you have like a PhD or a master's in electrical engineering unable to work in the U.S. economy, and they really funnel all of that brain power into activities like this with their kids. But despite all of this, because the spelling bee is such an American activity, you do see these people as, these people have become targets of a lot of racial prejudice as well. And so this became apparent, especially in 2014, when the National Spelling Bee named co-champions Eunsoon Sujo and Shriram Hathwar, and Twitter just erupted. And this was one of the first years that the National Spelling Bee had kind of created a Twitter presence for itself. And there were many racist tweets that came out, and they were called twacists by the people who identified them. And so I'll read these if you can't see them. Why are there no American kids left in the spelling bee? I'm ashamed of our kind. Parents, step it up. One year I wish an American kid could win the spelling bee, and nothing more American than a good spelling bee. Oh, wait, all the Caucasians are eliminated. So this sort of xenophobia that emerged in May 2014, you know, caused outcry from the spelling bee world. The Anti-Defamation League issued a statement. There was definitely some public address of this process. And the biggest kind of piece that addressed it the following year on the eve of the spelling bee was this one: Indian Americans dominate the National Spelling Bee. Why should they take abuse on social media for it? So, you know, every time this issue gets addressed, it still doesn't move the conversation away from them being Indian American winners, as one champion pointed out to me. He's like, I just want to be a winner. I just want to be a champion of this thing. I don't want to be an Indian American champion of this thing, right? And so this sort of otherizing and exclusionary dynamic keeps repeating itself in that very kind of forever foreigner trope. So we saw this in 2017 more recently when the 2017 champion was interviewed on CNN and the host Allison Camarota suggests that it must have been easy for her to spell her final word because she speaks Sanskrit at home, right? So this is like, this is another father who spoke it. I'll go back to that. We are not sure whether its roots are actually in Sanskrit, which is what you were probably used to using. So there's just a lot of ignorance around even who this immigrant group is and how to make sense of them. Sanskrit is a dead language. It's like saying people speak Latin. No one's speaking to one another in Latin, especially, you know, not at a child age like that. So, you know, it's certainly caused people who have the ability to speak out about it to speak out. And my favorite is the New York-based comedian Hari Kondabolu, who has said, you know, now finally brown people get to say to white people, hey, learn English, which is, I think, very apt. And this is before his whole Apu controversy. But just in conclusion, I'll say that I think one of the things that I've tried to tie this whole process to of this sort of human capital building that happens in these early years in the spelling bee and then plays out through high school and then affects anything from the specialized high school admissions process to the college admissions process where, you know, there's been such a backlash against Asian Americans. I think a lot of it is just, you know, it's causing a threat to very, generations-old processes of white mobility and white middle-class social reproduction because of, you know, the number of immigrants and because it's just, you know, the whole tide of the United States racially and ethnically is shifting. So we can think about this in terms of the mono-minority stereotype that was introduced in 1966, but probably only to some degree. One of the ways that it's the kind of central ideas of the model minority stereotype still play out in the spelling bee is this idea of Asian Americans as model citizens who are self-sufficient and, you know, just know how to do everything well on their own, and how they're always pitted against African Americans who are continually represented through these narratives of anti-blackness, as being a problem for the state. And so you see this play out even in this otherwise very cheerful film, many of you may have seen Aquila and the Bee, in which you have this underdog protagonist, Aquila, who is in a very under-resourced school, and this ruthless Indian American family who wants their kid to win at all costs. And so rather than drawing attention to the fact that it's really the U.S. government who has both imported STEM labor instead of producing its own, and they haven't fixed the schools so that people like Aquila have a shot at making it to the spelling bee just like the immigrant kid, you know, it just all gets kind of put on the kids themselves. And the Asian American family is once again seen as taking resources from other families. So I will leave it there, and I welcome your questions. These are just some questions I continue to think about. What can the concept of generation explain about Asian American life, and what is the impact of Asian Americans on the millennial generation, Generation Z, and as they are continue to be born, Generation Alpha? So I will leave it there, and thank you very much. Yeah, I think that it's actually nowadays very tricky to perform in the National Spelling Bee because it has become so hard. And so one of the things this community has done is shared information among itself. It's also become something of a prestige activity in this community because they've seen other kids start to win at it. I guess in terms of an origin story, I think many of them cite Spellbound, that documentary, which by chance captured this very, like, you know, fairly well-balanced, nice kid, Indian American girl, winning, right? And then she ends up being this, like, promise of all these other families who don't have too many other ins into American society at this level. And then at the same time, the spelling bee starts to gain prominence as a cool thing to do. ESPN is putting it on primetime. These kids have all this other practice in these minor league circuits. So I think the combination has just resulted in this happening. And I think this happens with other groups with other things, but none of them are on ESPN, so we just don't know. Yes?
When you briefly mentioned like the networking within groups to kind of spur interest, is that similar to like how you were saying the math competition is more so for these regions?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that the spelling bees run through schools, like schools have to participate in the National Spelling Bee, and so it's administered at the school level, right? So you're supposed to have a classroom bee and then a grade-wide bee and a school bee, and that feeds into your district and so on and so on. So I think that that has, you know, really cemented this activity. But are you asking specifically for Indian Americans?
I'm just curious as to how it kind of groups by different races. So how you were just mentioning,
yeah,
some of them go to the math ones, some of them go to the spelling.
Yeah, and I think that, like, if you look at who shows up at the National Spelling Bee, you have kids of all races and ethnicities. It's just the ones that, as the competition goes deeper, the ones who are actually making it to the finals, then it's much less balanced, and you don't see too many East Asian Americans. Like, you don't see very many Chinese Americans in that. And I think it's because they share information on how to prepare. And I think it's because they have these minor league bees, you know. And also because Britain colonized South Asia. And you have all of these people who, all these parents who are educated in English medium schools, which is not the case in China. You know, there's a much lower rate of English fluency. And this, and in this instance, people, I wondered, why not the Philippines? Like, why aren't there more Filipino kids in the spelling bee? Because the Philippines has American English, right? Like, the U.S. military presence in the Philippines should have perhaps made them equally as interested. But that just phenomenal, it just hasn't happened to the same degree. Though I do have at least one Filipino-American speller in my book who's very interesting. Yeah. Yes.
So I have two questions.
Okay.
She brought up a good point. So I'm just wondering, because you talk a lot about the Generation Z and stuff like that, and obviously technology is a big part of that.
Yeah.
I know, like, back in the day, and from my personal experience, like, Chinese communities, they, you know, word of mouth sometimes, there's, like, posters or whatever. How did they know about the stuff, like, whether it's resources or even the competitions themselves? Obviously, there are the schools, like you said, but is there any other kind of, like, resources that they didn't take advantage of to get, like, but I'm basically asking, are there other, like, special, like, spelling bee, like, things that parents talk about that maybe other parents don't talk about?
Like, once their kids are in it, or just to hear about it to begin with?
Just hear about it in general. So,
yeah, so, I mean, they make ads for satellite TV and for the, I don't know what it's officially called, but in my house we called it the Saturday morning programs, the TV Asia programs that come on local access TV. They advertise there. Sony TV is the broadcaster of the South Asian Spelling Bee, so they're constantly advertising about it. So when people tune in for their Bollywood film or their you know, their Hindi or Tamil language soap opera or whatever, they're seeing these ads. They're also, like, India Currents is a magazine, India Abroad is a newspaper. They see all of the ads in those.
And are the ads kind of like, what do they kind of, like, say to their parents or to?
They are kind of aspirational, and the one that I've seen the most says, "Can your child spell?" And it's, I don't know, it's a weirdly provocative question, because you're like, well, if my child can't spell, what am I doing wrong, right? It's like what to, for I feel like when I look at that ad. But I think it's supposed to be inviting, and it's like a silhouette of a kid at a microphone, and then this giant cartoon bee for the South Asian Spelling Bee. And then once they go to that, they hear about the not-for-profit one, which doesn't advertise at all.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. At that case, I wonder how they got all the information. And that was the build off of hers. My original one was, I'm very interested in, like, kind of like the research that you did, like, at the people themselves.
Yeah.
I was wondering, because obviously there's a lot of South Asians in America.
Yeah.
I was wondering, did you kind of, like, find differences depending on their geographic, like, location? Or did you,
like, differences in how good they were?
Or not how good they were. Like, did more people from this area participate versus from, like, California? Or did more people, like that?
Well, so you can think about geographic difference in a couple of ways. One is that there are already these places that drew a lot of Indian immigrants that were very difficult to make it because the competition was so bad. So Houston is really tough. Silicon Valley is a really tough area. Of course, New York City, because it's so populated. And so sometimes you see these parents, like, moving to rural Texas to establish an address so they can make it, their kid could make it to the spelling bee from a less competitive area. And one parent commutes, you know, to their job in the major city. But another way that regionally this plays out is that, you know, as kids make it deeper and deeper in, or if you look at who the champions are, they're primarily from South India, which is kind of interesting because in South India, like those states rejected Hindi as a national language and accepted English, and they tend to be more communist and a little bit more, some of them are matrilineal, like the descent is through the mother's side. So it's kind of interesting too, like they're the ones, they and people from Bengal who have always had a very literary and poet rich history, they tend to do the best at the spelling bee as well. Yeah.
And to kind of just like follow up, so for example, like there's a kung fu tournament in California that's really, that they claim to be national, right?
Uh-huh.
And that draws obviously a lot of people from California.
Mm-hmm.
On the East Coast, they're kind of like, what is that? I've never heard of it before.
Okay.
So what I'm asking is, are there like kind of these unifying, are these competitions unifying in the sense that like all the South Asians kind of know about them and go to them as like the go-to spelling bee, or is it kind of like...
Well, the national spelling bee is actually national.
Yeah.
Like all 50 states are represented. And that's because newspapers have to sponsor, or at least the original model was that newspapers would sponsor spellers. And as the newspaper industry has declined, they've gotten a little more creative with the sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, like, an NFL team, the Tennessee Titans, sponsors a speller for 1 year. Like Overstock.com, the website,
right,
sponsored a speller. Like they'll let other sponsors bring spellers to Washington, D.C. But really the whole original model of it was that these different newspapers would sponsor their speller and also send a journalist to D.C. to track their speller. And then they would report back to their hometown paper. Like, this is before the internet,
yeah,
right? And so this model has somewhat eroded over the decades, especially given how print journalism has really, you know, floundered in the last decade in terms of sales and so on. But that's kind of, it is a national contest. With the South Asian ones in particular, they're not in all 50 states. They're in these diasporic areas of concentration. So anywhere there are these big Indian American communities,
yeah,
that's where they'll hold the contest. Yeah.
And so what I'm asking though is like, so for example, would an Indian American from another state have the same impression of the spelling bee as a South Asian person like Silicon Valley?
Maybe, but I have to say as a something of a disclaimer, like a lot of people, like there are about over 5 million South Asian Americans in the United States, and most of them don't understand this at all. They don't understand why people spend their time like this. They don't understand, you know, if I can quote my mom, are these words even English? You know, like people don't culturally fully understand this phenomenon. So it is a really small subset of the population. It's also a very first-generation immigrant thing to do. So all of the parents are new immigrants with their young kids, really trying to like give them the best kind of educational start possible. Let me give you a point of contrast. I'm an immigrant. I was born in India. I grew up in Queens, so I mostly grew up in the United States. But when I would go to these things, people would be like, why are you asking us all these questions? Why aren't you here with your kids? Like, you know, kind of suggesting that, like, for them, this is a very normal parenting thing to do. But for me, like, this was not a normal parenting thing. It wasn't a default kind of way that I would want to raise my kids.
Oh,
so, yes.
I have a question. Out of the children you interviewed, did you feel that any of them were almost being pressured by their parents in order to participate in the Indian community, in order to participate in this spelling bee? Because from what you told me, like, that can your child read in the Indian newspaper?
Spell, yeah.
Spell. It almost sounds as if it's like a prestige in the Indian
it
community
is.
To have their children participate.
Yeah, it is a prestige thing. But it's also, so I think that when people bring their kids to these regional contests on a Saturday, you know, and they come with the whole family and, you know, they do this thing, some of those kids are definitely not happy to be there. Like, they are kids who are, like, getting dragged to this thing. They want it to be over. They go through the motions, and then it's over. Those kids, sure, they're being pressured. But the kids who are really into it and want to win, the parents certainly drive the process because it's so complicated how to study for this that you can't do it without a lot of adult intervention. And it wasn't always a parent. Like, sometimes it was someone from the school. Sometimes it was a paid coach. But, like, some adult has to drive this process because, you know, these kids are just, it's not an activity that even a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old could just navigate on their own. But I don't think those kids are being pushed into it.
So out of the children you interviewed, none of them were, let's say, pushed towards doing it?
No, but I saw the kids who were pushed toward doing it on at the regional level, and they weren't terribly bothered by it because I would ask them, like, how much time have you spent studying? They're like, I didn't study for this. You know, so they're not, but they had to show up and spend their day here, right? But another way... you know, like some of these parents, when they'd get asked about their second or third child and whether they were going to do it, you know, like some of them, either that sibling loved the spelling bee and couldn't wait to get into it or hated it and wanted to have nothing to do with it. And in those latter cases, the parents were like, we tried. You know, they weren't going to force it if it wasn't going to happen. So to me, that was an indication that they were being fairly reasonable about it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I love this question. And this is research that I've been trying to find just generally for this generation because most of what I've read about it has come from journalism. Like the New York Times had a really extensive article, I think 2 years ago, on stress and antidepressants and rising suicide rates UN report that I showed you called Her World, that too reported increased rates of depression, especially for girls. Because of the context that I met these kids in, like at a competition, I didn't see much of it. But, you know, I think what they told me is that, yeah, they're totally overscheduled. One of the things they've had to really learn, in addition to all these words, is how to manage stress. So they see stress as something to be managed already as really young children. So, and then as a college professor, I feel like in the last 7 or 8 years, every kid in my classroom has been so much more stressed out. So I see it happening, but it's more anecdotal. It's not something that, I'm not a mental health professional who has that kind of data, but it's on the rise. I think that there's no way you can start doing such competitive things that are this intense early and not burn out like much earlier as well. So it's not good news there at all. Yeah.
To piggyback on that, so you feel like it harms the students or the children in the long run?
I think that it's a really individual activity. So one of the reasons all these contests are so popular is because schools don't, like the U.S. education system is very steeped in a no child left behind, every student succeeds. Like they really try to downplay competition. So you see all this competition happening extracurricularly and on television so people can make money off of it. I think that, you know, kids who participate in a lot of these different activities at once could potentially burn out, but I don't think they have to. You know, I think it's a question of, like, what else are they doing in their lives and what kinds of ways are their parents also helping them to relax and have fun because they're so young. So I don't think it's harmful, like, as a default thing, but it could be. Like, anything could be.
Well, the reason I'm mentioning is because you said, you know, they study 8 hours on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And 4 hours every single day.
That's a lot, right? Yeah. And so when that kid finished, he just, you know, he stopped studying that much. And he went on to do other things, but he didn't, like, this felt like, for him, something he really wanted to do during that short period of time. Yes. Oh, So in 2014, 15, and 16, they ended up with co-champions, and the last time it had happened was in the 1960s. This Scripps has had, I think, six sets of co-champions in its history, but in order to do away with that, they instituted a tiebreak test so that in 2017 and 2018, they only had a single winner. And then they decided it was too many tests and they weren't going to have a tiebreak test. And then they ended up with eight winners because it was 11 p.m. at night. And some of these children looked like one kid actually came to the mic and started his turn with, "What time is it anyway?" You know, because they were just starting to fall asleep on the stage and they realized they had to call the contest. So there were eight kids left. And what they said was that we're going to have three more rounds. If each of you spells your word right in each of the next three rounds, you will each be named a champion. And so all eight of them spelled all three of their words correctly, and then they named themselves the Octo Champs. You can expect a major rule change to come this year because that was ridiculous. Yes?
So what is the standard for including a word in the universe of words to be presented to the competitors? Is it the Oxford English Dictionary?
No, Merriam-Webster. It's the Merriam-Webster. Now they're using the International Unabridged Dictionary. They change the dictionary they use every year. But the OED is British English. They would never use that for this contest. But the way that they do it is that they work very closely. There's a committee, a very secret committee, formed between the Scripps Foundation and the Merriam-Webster lexicographers, and they make a word list. And it's up to them to decide what is an easy word, what is a difficult word, what is a championship word, and they won't tell anyone anything about it. They're very tight-lipped about it. Yes?
What's your next pursuit?
Honestly, I need to see where my kid gets into high school. We're waiting for the high school results. I think I have to do a little bit of parenting in the meantime. I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I think they're tired of watching me write books. But when I get back to it, what I want to do is I did this research in Silicon Valley with kids that at the time I just talked about them as second generation South Asian American kids, but they're in this scheme, they would be millennials. And I'm very curious with what they're doing now and how, you know, like how, what kind of ways to rethink some of these generational categories by focusing much more on immigrant contributions. So something in that vein. I'm also really interested in Gen Z activism because that's just become something that has been amazing to watch, especially you know, in the last two or three years, and thinking about the way digital culture enables that. So both, probably some combination of those things. Yes?
This is the last thing. I was wondering, could you just walk, like, just tell us maybe some cool, like, facts that you learned about the lifestyles of these elite spellers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so one of the things that they would do is, like, they would just decorate their whole rooms with words, right? Like, there would be words everywhere. And it was part of that is like because they just started to like live in this world of words, which I thought was amazing, you know, especially some of them. The ones who were really excited about language were very early readers. Like they started reading chapter books when they were two or three, like very, very advanced readers for their age. And then these would be kids who would go on to write poetry and win essay contests, including the Asian American ones, not just the white ones. You know, because normally we don't often think about that level of creativity, especially with, you know, kids who were being raised in STEM households. But, you know, there was a lot of celebration of the language, and I thought that was really interesting. I thought that it was interesting that despite the number of families who would show up at these things, they'd still organize themselves around their own heritage languages. So all of the Tamil speakers would sit together, all the Mandarin speakers would sit together. There was a whole contingent from Ghana. They would sit together. Like, it was a very kind of UN model of going to the spelling bee. And then the other thing, I just Scripps as an organization was kind of fascinating, and I write about their history a little bit in the book, but they're a very Christian organization, and they're kind of like a prayer-ish thing before the dinner that they host. And, you know, there are all of these ways that they're trying to improve these kids spiritually and making them better people. So I just thought that was fascinating, because that's never anything ESPN would tell us, you know, when they're broadcasting this.
For sure. Thank
you. Yeah. Yes.
Thanks very much for a great talk. Just in terms of process, how long did it actually take you to write this book?
It took me about, I was doing the research for it over 5 years, not continuously, but over 5 years, while also working full-time and having those children I mentioned. So they, it was a bit of a juggling act, and I finished it during a sabbatical year. So I kind of wrote a lot of it intensively over summers and then over the year right before it was published. Yeah, I don't think academics just don't get a chance to write unless